So I'm going to be doing a reading from a book called An Unentangled Knowing by Upasika Gi Nanayan. This was translated by Ajahn Jeff. I think Debbie did a reading from this book or a similar collection. Yes, but it was funny, Alampur.
Pure and simple.
Pure and simple.
Yeah.
This is a talk called Breath Meditation Condensed. There are lots of people who are ashamed to talk about their own defilements, but who feel no shame at all talking about the defilements of others. Those who are willing to report their own diseases, their own defilements, in a straightforward manner are few and far between. As a result, the disease of defilement is hushed up and kept secret, so that we don't realize how serious and widespread it is. We all suffer from it, and yet no one is open about it. No one is really interested in diagnosing his or her own defilements. We have to find a skillful approach if we hope to wipe out this disease, and we have to be open about it, admitting our own defilements from the grossest to the most subtle levels, dissecting them down to their minutest details. Only then will we gain from our practice. If we look at ourselves in a superficial way, we may feel we're already fine just as we are, already know all we need to know. But then when the defilements let loose with full force as anger or delusion, we pretend that nothing is wrong. And in this way, the defilements become a hidden disease, hard to catch hold of, hard to diagnose. So are we still beasts of burden? Are we beasts of burden because defilements and craving are riding on our backs? Have they put a ring through our nose? When you get to the point where you've had enough, you have to stop. Stop and watch the defilements to see how they come into being, what they want, what they eat, what they find delicious. Make it your sport, watching the defilements and making them starve, like a person giving up an addiction. See if it gets the defilements upset. Do they hunger to the point where they're salivating? Then don't let them eat. No matter what, don't let them eat what they're addicted to. After all, there are plenty of other things to eat. You have to be hard on them, hard on yourself, like this. Hungry? Well, go ahead and be hungry. You're going to die? Fine. Go ahead and die. If you can take this attitude, you'll be able to win out over all sorts of addictions, all sorts of defilements, because you're not pandering to desire. You're not nourishing the desire that exists for the sake of finding flavor in physical things. It's time you stopped, time you gave up feeding these things. If they're going to waste away and die, let them die. After all, why should you keep them fat and well-fed? No matter what, you have to keep putting the heat on your cravings and defilements until they wither and waste away. Don't let them raise their heads. Keep them under your thumb. This is the sort of straightforward practice you have to follow. If you have endurance, if you put up a persistent fight until they're all burned away, then there's no other victory that can come anywhere near, no other victory that's anywhere near a match for the victory over the cravings and defilements in your own heart. This is why the Buddha taught us to put the heat on the defilements in all of our activities, sitting, standing, walking, and lying down. If we don't do this, they'll burn us in all our activities. If you consider things carefully, you'll see that the Buddha's teachings are exactly all right, both in how they tell us to examine the diseases of defilement and in how they tell us to let go, destroy, and extinguish defilement. All the steps are there, so we don't need to go study anywhere else. Every point in his doctrine and discipline shows us the way, so we needn't wonder how we can go about examining and doing away with these diseases. This becomes mysterious and hard to know only if we study his teachings without making reference to doing away with our own defilements. People don't like to talk about their own defilements, so they end up completely ignorant. They grow old and die without knowing a thing about their own defilements at all. When we start to practice, when we come to comprehend how the defilements burn our own heart, that's when we gradually come to know ourselves, to understand suffering and defilement, and to learn how to extinguish defilements. gives us space to breathe. When we learn how to put out the fires of defilement, how to destroy them, it means we have tools. We can be confident in ourselves, no doubts, no straying off into other paths of practice, because we're sure to see that practicing in this way, contemplating inconstancy, stress, and not selfness, in this way at all times, really gets rid of our defilements. The same holds true with the virtue, concentration, and discernment. There are tools, and we need a full set. We need the discernment that comes with right view and the virtue that comes with self-discipline. Virtue is very important. Virtue and discernment are like our right and left hands. If one of our hands is dirty, it can't wash itself. You need to use both hands to keep both hands washed and clean. So wherever there's virtue, you have to have discernment. Wherever there's discernment, you have to have virtue. Discernment is what enables you to know. Virtue is what enables you to let go, to relinquish, to destroy your addictions. Virtue isn't just a matter of 5 or 8 precepts, you know. It has to deal with the finest details. Whatever your discernment sees as a cause of suffering, you have to stop. You have to let go. Virtue is something that gets very subtle and precise. Letting go, giving up, renouncing, abstaining, cutting away, and destroying. All these things are an affair of virtue. This is why virtue and discernment have to go together, just like our right and left hands have to help each other. They help each other wash away defilement. That's when the mind can become centered, bright, and clear. These things show their benefits right at the mind. If we don't have these tools, it's as if we have, it's as if we had no hands or feet. We wouldn't be able to go anywhere at all. We have to use our tools, virtue and discernment, to destroy defilement. That's when our minds will benefit. This is why the Buddha taught us to keep training in virtue, concentration, and discernment. We have to keep fit in training these things. If we don't keep up the training, as we should, our tools for extinguishing suffering and defilement won't be sharp, won't be of much use. They won't be a match for the defilements. The defilements have monstrous power for burning the mind in a twinkling of an eye. Say that the mind is quiet and neutral. The slightest sensory contact can set things burning in an instant by making us pleased or displeased. Why? Sensory contact is our measuring stick for seeing how firm or weak our mindfulness is. Most of the time it stirs things up. As soon as there's contact, by way of the ear or eye, the defilements are very quick. When this is the case, how can we keep things under control? How are we going to gain control over our eyes? How are we going to gain control over our ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind? How can we get mindfulness and discernment in charge of these things? This is a matter of practice, pure and simple. Our own affair, something by which we can test ourselves to see why defilements flare up so quickly when sensory contact takes place. Say, for instance, that we hear a person criticizing someone else. We can listen and not get upset. But say that the thought occurs to us, they're actually criticizing me. As soon as we conjure up this me, we're immediately angry and displeased. If we contact very much of this me, we can get very angry. Just this fact alone should enable us to observe that as soon as our self gets involved, we suffer immediately. This is how it happens. If no sense of self comes out to get involved, we can remain calm and indifferent. When they criticize other people, we can stay indifferent. But as soon as we conclude that they're criticizing us, our self immediately appears and gets involved, and we immediately burn with defilement. We have to pay close attention to this. As soon as our self arises, suffering arises in the very same instant. The same holds true even if you're just thinking. The self you think up spreads out into all sorts of issues. The mind gets scattered all over the place with defilement, craving, and attachments. It has very little mindfulness and discernment watching over it, so it gets dragged every which way by defilement and craving. There are no physical tools you can use to detect or cure this disease of defilement because it arises only at sensory contact. There's no substance to it. It's like a match in a matchbox. As long as the match doesn't come into contact with the friction strip on the side of the box, it won't give rise to fire. But as soon as we strike it against the side of the box, it bursts into flame. If it goes out right then, all that gets burned is the match head. If it doesn't stop at the match head, it'll burn the match stick. If it doesn't stop with the match stick and meets up with anything flammable, it can grow into an enormous fire. When defilement arises in the mind, it starts from the slightest contact. If we can be quick and put it out right there, it's like striking a match that flares up for an instant and then dies down right at the match head. The defilement disbands right there. But if we don't put it out in an instant, it arises. And then let it start concocting issues. It's like pouring fuel on a fire. We have to observe the disease of defilement in our own minds to see what their symptoms are, why they are so quick to flare up. They can't stand to be disturbed. The minute you disturb them, they flare up into flame. When this is the case, what can we do to prepare ourselves beforehand? How can we stock up on mindfulness before sensory contact strikes? The way to stock up is to practice meditation, as when we keep the breath in mind. This is what gets our mindfulness prepared so that we can keep ahead of defilement, so that we can keep it from arising, as long as we have our theme of meditation as an inner shelter for the mind. The mind's outer shelter is the body, which is composed of physical elements. But its inner shelter is the theme of meditation we use to train its mindfulness to be focused and aware. Whatever theme we use is the inner shelter for the mind that keeps it from wandering around, concocting thoughts and imaginings. This is why we need a theme of meditation. Don't let the mind chase after its preoccupations, the way ordinary people who don't meditate do. Once we have a meditation theme to catch this monkey of a mind so that it will become less and less willful, day by day, it'll gradually calm down. Calm down until it can stand firm for long or short periods, depending on how much we train and observe ourselves. Now, as for how we do breath meditation, the texts say to breathe in long and out long, heavy or light, and then to breathe in short and out short, again heavy or light. These are the first steps in the training. After that, we don't have to focus on the length of the in-breath or the out-breath. Instead, we simply gather our awareness at any one point of the breath and keep this up until the mind settles down and is still. When the mind is still, you then focus on the stillness of the mind. At the same time, you are aware of the breath. At this point, you don't focus directly on the breath. You focus on the mind that's still and at normalcy. You focus continually on the normalcy of the mind. At the same time, you are aware of the breath coming in and out without actually focusing on the breath. You simply stay with the mind, but you watch it with each in and out breath. Usually when you're doing physical work and your mind is at normalcy, you can know what you're doing. So why can't you be aware of the breath? After all, it's part of the body. Some of you are new at this, which is why you don't know how you can focus on the mind at normalcy with each in and out breath without focusing directly on the breath itself. What we're doing here is practicing how to be aware of the body and mind, pure and simple, in and of themselves. Start out by focusing on the breath for about 5, 10, or 20 minutes. Breathe in long and out long, or in short and out short. At the same time, notice the stages and how the mind feels, how it begins to settle down when you have mindfulness watching over the breath. You've got to make a point of observing this, because usually you breathe out of habit, with your attention far away. You don't focus on the breath. You're not really aware of it. This leads you to think that it's hard to stay focused here, but actually it's quite easy. After all, the breath comes in and out on its own, by its very nature. There's nothing at all difficult about breathing. It's not like the other themes of meditation. For instance, if you're going to practice recollection of the Buddha or Budo, you have to keep on repeating Budo, Budo, Budo. Actually, if you want, you can repeat Budo in the mind with each in and out breath, but only in the very beginning stages. You repeat Budo to keep the mind from concocting thoughts about other things. Simply by keeping up this repetition, you can weaken the mind's tendency to stray, for the mind can take on only one object at a time. This is something you have to observe. The repetition is to prevent the mind from thinking up thoughts and clambering after them. After you've kept up the repetition, you don't have to count the number of times. The mind will settle down to be aware of the breath with each in and out breath. It will begin to be still, neutral, at normalcy. This is when you focus on the mind instead of the breath. Let go of the breath and focus on the mind, but still be aware of the breath on the side. You don't have to make note of how long or short the breath is. Make note of the mind that stays at normalcy with each in and out breath. Remember this carefully so that you can put it into practice. Here I'd like to condense the steps of breath meditation to show how all four tetrads mentioned in the text can be practiced at once. In other words, it is possible to focus on the body, feelings, the mind, and the Dhamma all in one sitting. This is an important question for us all. You could, if you wanted to, precisely follow all the steps in the text so as to develop strong powers of mental absorption, jhana. But it takes a lot of time. It's not appropriate for those of us who are old and have only a little time left. What we need is a way of gathering our awareness at the breath long enough to make the mind firm, and then go straight on to examining how all fabrications are inconstant, stressful, and not self, so that we can see the truth of all fabrications with each in and out breath. If you can keep at this continually, without break, your mindfulness will become firm and snug enough to give rise to the discernment that will enable you to gain clear knowledge and vision. So what follows is a guide in the steps in practicing a condensed form of breath meditation. Give them a try until you find they give rise to knowledge of your own within you. The first thing when you're going to meditate on the breath is to sit straight and keep your mindfulness firm. Breathe in, breathe out. Make the breath feel open and at ease. Don't tense your hands, your feet, or any of your joints at all. You have to keep your body in a posture that feels appropriate to your breathing. At the beginning, breathe in long, out long, fairly heavily, and then gradually the breath will shorten, sometimes heavy, sometimes light. Then breathe in short and out short for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then change. After a while, when you stay focused mindfully on it, the breath will gradually change. Watch it change for as many minutes as you like. Then be aware of the whole breath, all of its subtle sensations. This is the third step of the first tetrad. Sabbakaya Pratisamvedi, focusing on how the breath affects the whole body by watching all the breath sensations in all the various parts of the body, and in particular the sensations related to the in and out breath. From there, you focus on the sensation of the breath at any one point. When you do this correctly for a fairly long while, the body, the breath, will gradually grow still. The mind will grow calm. In other words, the breath grows still together with the awareness of the breath. When the subtleties of the breath grow still at the same time that your undistracted awareness settles down, the breath grows even more still. All the sensations in the body gradually grow more and more still. This is the fourth step, the stilling of bodily fabrication. As soon as this happens, you begin to be aware of the feelings that arise with the stilling of the body and mind. Whether they are feelings of pleasure or rapture or whatever, they appear clearly enough for you to contemplate them. The stages through which you have already passed, watching the breath come in and out long and short, should be enough to make you realize, even though you may not have focused on the idea, that the breath is inconstant. It's continually changing from in long and out long to in short and out short, from heavy to light, and so forth. This should enable you to read the breath, to understand that there's nothing constant to it at all. It changes on its own from one moment to the next. Once you have realized the inconstancy of the body, in other words, of the breath, you'll be able to see the subtle sensations of pleasure and pain in the realm of feeling. So now you watch feelings right there in the same place where you've been focusing on the breath. Even though they are feelings that arise from the stillness of the body or mind, they are nevertheless inconstant, even in that stillness. They can change. So these changing sensations in the realm of feeling exhibit inconstancy in and of themselves, just like the breath. When you see this change in the body, change in feelings, and change in the mind, this is called seeing the Dhamma, that is, seeing inconstancy. You have to understand this correctly. Practicing the first tetrad of breath meditation contains all four tetrads of breath meditation. In other words, you see the inconstancy of the body and then contemplate feeling. You see the inconstancy of feeling and then contemplate the mind. The mind, too, is inconstant. This inconstancy of the mind is the Dhamma. To see the Dhamma is to see this inconstancy. When you see the true nature of all inconstant things, then keep track of that inconstancy at all times, with every in and out breath. Keep this up in all your activities to see what happens next. What happens next is dispassion, letting go. This is something you have to know for yourself. This is what condensed breath meditation is like. I call it condensed because it contains all the steps at once. You don't have to do one step at a time. Simply focus at one point, the body, and you'll see the inconstancy of the body. When you see the inconstancy of the body, you'll have to see feeling. Feeling will have to show its inconstancy. The mind's sensitivity to feeling, or its thoughts and imaginings, are also inconstant. All of these things keep on changing. This is how you know inconstancy. If you can become skilled at looking and knowing in this way, you'll be struck with the inconstancy, stress, and not-selfness of yourself. And you'll meet with a genuine Dhamma. The Dhamma that's constantly changing like a burning fire, burning with inconstancy, stress, and not-selfness, is the Dhamma of the impermanence of all fabrications. But further in the mind, or in the property of consciousness, there's something special, beyond the reach of any kind of fire. There's no suffering or stress of any kind at all. This thing that lies inside, you could say that it lies within the mind, but it really isn't in the mind. It's simply that the contact is there at the mind. There's no way you can really describe it. Only the extinguishing of all defilement will lead you to know it for yourself. This something special within that exists by its very nature. But ordinarily, defilements have it surrounded on all sides. All these counterfeit things, the defilements, keep getting in the way and take possession of everything, so that this special nature remains imprisoned inside at all times. Actually, there's nothing in the dimension of time that can be compared with it. There's nothing by which you can label it. But it's something that you can pierce through to see. That is, by piercing through defilement, craving, and attachment into the state of mind that's pure, bright, and silent. This is the only thing that's important. And it doesn't only have one level. There are many levels from the outer bark to the inner bark and on to the sapwood before you reach the heartwood. The genuine Dhamma is like the heartwood, but there's a lot to the mind that isn't heartwood. The roots, the branches, and leaves of the tree are more than many, but there's only a little heartwood. The parts that aren't heartwood will gradually decay and disintegrate, but the heartwood doesn't decay. That's one kind of comparison we can make. It's like a tree that dies standing. The leaves fall away, the branches rot away, the bark and sapwood rot away, leaving nothing but the true heartwood. That's one comparison we can make with this thing we call deathless. This property that has no birth, no death, no changing. We can also call it Nibbana, or the unfabricated. It's all the same thing. Now then, isn't this something worth trying to break through to see?
remember in years past hearing talk about what like the different core lot or monastery regulations at her retreat center. Like there were specific things like maybe she didn't allow caffeine or other things. I was just curious if you knew of any of the particulars of like
Yeah, there's no caffeine. A strictly vegetarian. Can't think of anything else off my head. Those are the things that I remember.
And is it like a woman-only center, or is it like separated between men and women? Or
I was actually going to say that I think it might be only. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that men are allowed to stay overnight. Mm. That's what my kind of memory was, but I'm not 100% sure of that. But that I think it's a recollection that may or may not be valid.
Do you think all those rules were like written down, like the Lompoc Cha regulations, or is it more?
Probably, because especially after. As she was getting older, then she set things in place, so that the routine of the monastery continued on, and the standards of practice continued on. After she passed away, then her sister became the head person. Then after her sister died, then they just fairly recently passed away, so it's there's been others who have carried on the training and the practice there. So it's so that it's something that is relying on fairly fundamental training. Standards of practice, similar to Wat Pa Kwan. It's one of the reasons I think why, let's say, Wat Pa Kwan actually continues on reasonably smoothly is the standard of training and expectations are pretty clearly laid out.
Yeah,
Wat Pa Kwan
is Did she have any well-known disciples that went on to do other things, or?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know. I haven't really spent so. It's been almost 20 years now since I really lived in Thailand. And it's over in. Pepper is kind of on the other side of the country. There tends to be fairly strong regional affiliations in Thailand.
It's interesting, the vegetarian thing. Some people are very clear about it, like the Buddha or Lompa Man. And then you'll have sort of here and there sort of aberrations like Ajahn Gunha or Kwasi Gi.
I think it's I guess just this is a particular teachers will find it useful, and then they'll just lay it down, and say places like Ajahn Gunha and Ajahn Upasika Gi, then they just sort of lay it down, and people get to know after a while. They don't make it a source of righteous indignation against the meat eaters. where I say something like, oh dear, Santia Sok, then, which is another sort of group of monastics, and they tend to turn that into a mission to expose the nefarious deeds of the mediators.
What I refer to as vegan jellicles.
Huh?
Vegan jellicles.
One can just sort of chalk it up to the sort of different temperaments, personality.
Different temperaments, different personalities, yeah. I'm not exactly sure when Ajahn Gampa started. Being a vegetarian very early on, he saw the benefit of it for himself. Oftentimes it begins as simplicity, as well as that sense of not encouraging the lay people to be either taken by themselves or being it's like a, let's say like a 1 minute chant, it's actually mostly vegetarian. And using it as a, but it's not really hard to fix and accept what it was offered, but really like all the food that's prepared in the monastery is vegetarian. And lay people know that quite well, and it gets people thinking. It's a useful tool.
Here we say here at the monastery, when people ask,
right,
then we tell them we prefer vegetarian.
Yeah. And try to encourage people to consider it.
My guess is they weren't smoking their boxy beans, but
I would expect not.
No caffeine, no meat, but cigarettes.
Yeah. I know that. Monks, over the last 20 years in particular, a place like the Vasikakis, I'm sure they stopped a long time ago. But the Department of Public Health has been very much campaigning against smoking, trying to get the monasteries on board, for the most part, somewhat successful.
In her description of the mind at neutral normalcy, mm-hmm. normalcy stance, she kind of described it as having one's meditation object always, at least in the background, kind of constantly in awareness, as well as aware of the mind state,
mm-hmm.
whilst also doing whatever you're doing, walking or washing dishes or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And her emphasis is like, that's something you want to cultivate so that you're doing it 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
When Ajahn Chah is talking about the mind at normal state, is he talking about that same condition?
Yes.
It's pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, pretty much the same.
Continuous mindfulness.
It's like a mindfulness, a continuity of mindfulness and discernment but there's also a sense of ease there, and that's where that normalcy is at this. There's a sense of at ease. It's not normal to be tightly holding it to an object. So there's an ease to that. So I think it's a helpful qualification because oftentimes we try too hard to keep the mind on its object and keep the mind steady, which are all good things to be doing, but there's a lack of ease and balance there. So that sense of balance and normal is a the mind is drawn to that clarity rather than forced to stay with the clarity. I think that's where that sense of interest is really important. Taking interest in what am I going to.
She also talks about having this within this state of normalcy, constantly contemplating constancy, dukkha, and of all phenomena that's occurring in awareness.
Yeah.
And to me, that sounds like juggling a bunch of pork keys or something.
Right. It sounds like you're really busy,
mm-hmm.
and strained actually, but. The actual experience is one of there's a clarity that is fluid, and so then it's recognizing the instability and that tone of stress of non-ownership. And the relinquishment is a part of that.
So, I kind of taste the flavor of that a little bit. But that ability to hold the meditation object, go through your daily routines, keep an eye on the mind, sort of tone, watch the stress flavor of all arising phenomena. It seems like a fairly advanced practice state to arrive at in order to sort of be able to maintain that 24 hours a day?
Totally. But it's also, it's a great option if you don't want to suffer. And that's the flavor of it, is that there's this delight in not suffering.
Right. She talks about like making a sport out of sort of denying your defilements.
Yeah.
So what's not clear to me quite yet is that a sport of denying the sort of having fun denying your defilements come about as a result of dwelling in that space of continuous mindfulness, or does a continuous mindfulness come about from going through the suffering of forcing yourself not to enjoy anything?
I think that's where playing with it is really helpful. You know, in that sense of, oh, let's try this and see what works, and that's not working. Let's try this. And then it starts to feed itself, and the momentum starts to move towards, and that's where that sense of relinquishment plays such a strong role, because relinquishment isn't so much a giving up something that we have, but a kind of enjoying the non-moving to get sort of thing you're trying to make.
One way of thinking about that seems to be useful here is just reflecting on how reflexes work, how you can develop. Like when you first drive a car, you never think that you know, it seems like impossible to be able to do anything else other than focus right on how to drive that car.
Mm-hmm.
but pretty much everybody eventually can multitask amazingly, and they're still driving a car safely.
They think they can. They're talking to themselves.
Right. There are some, you know, it's not perfect.
It's not a perfect analogy.
But, or for instance,
which is
an even better one would be walking. Right. You almost never think, oh man, if I lose my concentration, I'm going to fall over. I won't be able to walk.
Yeah.
You know, so that might be an even better one.
Right.
So you can, yeah.
That's where there's no such thing as a perfect analogy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but I can. The point is well taken. That's something that that you start to do and gain skill in when you first start it. Man, I'm never going to be able to get this down. But over time, it becomes second nature.
But what do you mean when you say try something and know it's not working, or it is working? And how do you know that it's not just another kind of defilement sneaking in and going, oh, this is not working, when maybe it is working?
Well, I mean, the thing is that it's around the degree of clarity and ease, well-being. So both of those, because sometimes something doesn't work because, and there's just this, you know, there's no clarity, there's no well-being, so you want to try something else. And so both of those qualities, that's an indication of something. Okay, this is working. There's some clarity. There's a well-being. There's a steadiness there. Okay, this is going in the right direction. And then, you know, inevitably there'll be something that because we can get used to something working and something, and then. Yeah, our habits slip in, our defilements, or I'm trying to think of the word. Just an assumption. We start running on automatic pilot, and we're actually not attentive, and it slips away from us.
Is that where, when one isn't meditating per se, but where virtue would come in as also to illuminate whether we've slipped or not? So,
I mean, it's both, and that's really where I think Upasigaki really emphasized that function of virtue. And of course, Ajahn Chah similarly put a big emphasis on the cultivation of virtue. And it's not just to keep the rules, but it's more like the keeping of like an integrity and a self-worth, that when one starts to slip up on one level, even if it's on a reflect on a mental level, then there's a virtue that's there that starts, flags start going up, start shooting flares and saying, hey, whoa, wait a minute here. Whereas on the kind of the discernment level, it's, you know, it's kind of around, you know, because sometimes the Ajahn Chah says, you know, the defilements have their wisdom also, you know. We can convince ourselves of things, and that's where the virtue is this strong, maybe it's sort of like a bass player in a band. It isn't so flashy, but it really keeps everything on track.
I also remember hearing a talk that we've been doing, the help of Kalyanamita in that role as well, sort of check it out, see how we're doing.
Yeah. So those are like having the internal and the external is really very helpful.
She talks a little bit about virtue acting as like the other hand of discernment. Because these two things are like tag team experience. And that whenever virtue discerns stress, discernment discerns stress. Virtue is what lets go of the cause of stress. So like virtue is the thing that doesn't disband it.
Yeah, I thought that was curious.
I can kind of see it, but it's almost like virtue is a funny word for it because it sounds like that's an aspect of dispassion.
Right.
That's usually the way I think of it.
Well, I think maybe because virtue has a of course, English it's kind of fairly narrow, but sila in terms of say in the Pali, then has a wider application. It's like in the Visuddhimagga, it's sort of they pulled it together, and there's like the sila of the precepts. But then there's the sila of the sense restraint, sila of the use of requisite, and sila of the
livelihood.
Yes. So then you start saying, okay, sila is starting to carry through, and then they're accomplished in different ways, so that they. Center state is accomplished through mindfulness. The sila of precepts is accomplished through faith, which is interesting. And then with the requisites, I think is
wisdom,
and then the livelihood is through effort. So that there's you start to this is starting to unpack and turn into something quite integrated. Starts to bleed into all the different aspects of our life.
And here Yodhipa has a sort of recognizing quality to it.
Yes, and that's another aspect of when Ajahn Chah would talk about sila, he would always say its fundamental aspect of virtue is that sense of hiri yodhipa, where the mind is sensitive to what it's doing, the results that are going to have.
When an aversion or habit pattern, defilement is so strong, even with observing and seeing the suffering, still the mind says, I'm not going to give that up.
Uh-huh,
yeah. Do you have any suggestions for softening that, or sneaking in the back door through that, or somehow presenting to that strong sense of no?
No, just keep suffering. You'll get fed up with it. Don't try to sugarcoat it. Don't try to make it sound reasonable.
Looking at those two about this talk, it sounded like she was kind of going through dependent origination, and she was wanting a sense contact, or a contact, and then really putting a big emphasis on catching it there. Mm-hmm. Whereas I've always been taught it was the next one's feeling, it's feeling where you can break it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I've never heard of what kind of saying you can break it earlier.
Yeah, different teachers will use different points or emphasize different points. a lot of it is where your
most interested in establishing that mindfulness and reflection, because that's the critical factor.
Because you take the bath from there, like, okay, you see the contact, you see the suffering that arises, then you go back to renunciation. You prevent the senses from going out.
Yeah, and that, again, sometimes the, and this is where practice tradition sometimes, you know, they don't feel obligated to be, completely faithful to the text.
Well, you were talking about relinquishment and how seeing the positive aspect of it, you know, how, like, that's really what is kind of cheering on in terms of forgetting. Going in terms of relinquishment, it's like that there's a positive element of giving up and letting go.
Oh.
And when, similar to what Jeff asked, like when it's painful giving up and you give up and you're just like, is it like sort of you only so much earlier, you need to really pay attention to, wait a minute, I'm just focusing on the negative part of giving up and really like not switching my mind to like look at.
Yeah, exactly. One's just sort of, one's taking this, what it's doing is taking the stand of self. Because the self doesn't want to give up anything, period. And it'll just moan and complain about everything. Mm. And that they're wonderful word in Thai that it's hard to translate, but the kind of, there's a kind of a, almost like a regret and longing that comes from having to give up things. See, it dies. It's sort of like, so that just that you know, having to give up particular pleasure or a particular view or an opinion or a particular aversion, and even when one knows it's painful, there's still that feeling, you know, I just don't want to give it up. And you know, it's really helpful to really acknowledge that. But then that's where, actually, and that's where one uses that sense of playing and challenging. Because if it's cast in sort of this epic struggle against me and the divine, it just gets really heavy. Whereas, you know, taking it on is, you know, it's kind of a challenge or playful, saying, oh, let's try this. Or seeing, oh, what's the, you know, what's the big deal? Why do I hold on so tight? What's the, and you know, kind of making fun of oneself, and to be able to practice or to gain results from there is a sense of having to have a kind of a humility and a sense of humor, and that, an appreciation of the absurd. Because, you know, what we do on a regular day-to-day basis to make ourselves miserable, you know, it's absurd.
มันจะค่อยๆน้อยลงตอนแรกก็เยอะใช่ไหมคะ and then you can feel sadai decreasing.
Yes, that's Jeet's contribution to the same. Yeah, there is that feeling of the regret and longing, and that sadai is too fast, too bad, get better, but that decreases. That's when does not go or challenges it, and it's decreased.
It seems that it's like that, there's that idea that it's going to be suffering to give something up, but then when we actually give it up, then it decreases the suffering, but it's the idea, I think, the block before giving it up, because giving up isn't suffering, actually.
Oh, it can be suffering.
That's a good point. Like, I've experienced that the whole ordeal bit beforehand, all the imagination, what it's going to be like.
Correct.
And then actually doing it, and it's like, then a couple minutes later, like forgetting.
Yeah, it's like, they, oh, what the heck, was it like again? It's like when we have given up something, or when we haven't got what we wanted, when the mind goes back to that, it was a non-event anyway, sort of, in the sense of that, it's like, you know, so, you know, we wanted this so bad, or we thought we needed this so much, or it had to be this way, and then we didn't, and it didn't happen for some reason, but then you reflect on it later, and say, well, it was kind of a non-event. It was all around. It was around projection and hope and fear. Okay, thank you. It was a great discussion.